I'm going to start by teaching you guys a word. I have it's kind of an English major, and so words are a big deal. Maybe it's not a new word to you. If it's not, don't feel offended by my presumptiveness. Just probably not a word, presumptiveness. Anyway, the word I want to talk about is the word provenance. Not to be confused with providence. Provenance is a word that you'd probably hear a lot if you ran in art circles, mostly high-end buying of art, not making of art. Or if you were... or if you were sort of a high-end antiquer. It's essentially a fancy word for history. And it's referring to the history of an object that reveals something about the value of that object, which wouldn't necessarily be obvious just by looking at it. So you find out things like where it's been, who's owned it before, how it's been used, where it's been seen. And if you think about, you might not think that's important, but if you think about an antique or a painting, the provenance of that object becomes an important selling feature. A rusted out flask from the 20s might not seem that interesting, unless you find out that it was Ernest Hemingway's, perhaps. An Art Deco lamp might not be that great, unless you find out that it once sort of lit a Rockefeller's home. And a dusty old typewriter might not be that attractive, unless you find out that, say, F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote The Great Gatsby on it. Changes its meaning, changes its value, tells you something about the object. Especially in the art collecting world, as I was saying, the provenance of an object is extremely important. Thousands of dollars are spent researching to verify the path that, say, a painting or a sculpture would have taken from its creation to its place on an auction block. Because after all, if you're going to spend millions of dollars on a painting by Van Gogh, you want to make sure it's by Vincent and not, say, Jerry Van Gogh. Anyway, it's a lot of talk about that word. Just as a way of introducing the idea of reading the Bible with the idea of provenance, with the idea of thinking about the stories that go on and how they affect the characters. Now, not all the characters in the Bible have this slowly fleshed out sort of provenance. A lot of them show up for like one or two verses, and then they're gone. But others can be traced through multiple chapters. They can even they show up in different books, things like that. And it's really interesting to sort of take a look at that and see how this larger story reveals something about God's, the role sort of God plays in the provenance of people's lives. So the reason I'm talking about that is because I want to talk about one of the more interesting characters in the Bible in terms of provenance and seeing how God works through history, and that's Joseph from the Old Testament. Joseph of the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, if any of you have ever seen Donny Osmond put that on. Or Jane, actually. Maples Collegiate, 2001.
It's elementary school.
Oh. But you were Joseph. I'm going to sleep on the couch tonight, probably. Anyway, so I want to go through the story of Joseph, unless Jane wants to sing it for us. But it's pretty long, so I'm just going to try and break it down. I was going to read it, but it's about 10 chapters, and we'd be here till 10 o'clock. So, when I spoke 2 weeks ago, I was not really speaking, but reading this thing about Jacob. So Joseph is the son of Jacob. He was the son of, he's usually referred to as his favorite son, because he was the only child from his favorite wife. And so he was a good kid. He was a little bit naive, as evidenced by the fact that he liked to tell his older brothers about the dreams he had, in which it would appear that they were going to bow down to him. If any of you have older brothers, it's not a good idea to tell them that. One day his brothers decide, after all this storytelling that he does, that they're going to kill him. So they kind of come up with a plan of what they're going to do. But then they relent, and they decide that they're just going to throw him into a pit, because it would be bad to kill him. It wouldn't be as bad to just let him die on his own, apparently. In the end, they decide, though, that they shouldn't kill him or leave him in the pit, that they should sell him to slave traders, which would be much nicer, apparently. So they sell him, and they take this multicolored coat that was a gift from his father, the dream coat, and they tear it up and they dip it in goat's blood, and then they bring it to Joseph and they say, or they bring it to Jacob, sorry, and they tell him that Joseph has been killed by an animal. Clearly, Jacob is distraught, but the story goes on. So Joseph winds up in Egypt, where he ends up working for an official of the Egyptian government named Potiphar. While he's there, he becomes well-respected in the house, gets put in charge of a lot of stuff, until Potiphar's wife decides that she would like to now get to know Joseph a little bit better. Joseph rebuffs her advances, and so in her shame, she claims that he tried to molest her. Potiphar isn't too happy about this, clearly, and so he throws Joseph into prison for a few years. But remarkably, God sort of continues to bless Joseph. It says very quickly in the Bible that he becomes placed in charge of all of the prisoners in the prison. I'm not sure why you would put a prisoner in charge of the prisoner, but that's how it worked back then. He also becomes well known because he has this knack for interpreting dreams. One of the dreams he ends up interpreting is for one of Pharaoh's chief cupbearer who had been placed in prison. Joseph interprets his dream that he's told and correctly predicts that the cupbearer is going to get his job back. And yeah, so it turns out he's right. The cupbearer goes back to Pharaoh, is out of prison. And then the cupbearer completely forgets about Joseph until one night the Pharaoh has this very troubling dream, or two dreams actually. One of them, there's seven cows that are all healthy and everything, grazing. And then these seven skinny cows come out of the water, eat the seven larger cows, but don't seem to put on any weight. And then the other one's sort of the same idea, except with grains and things like that. So nobody in Pharaoh, all of his magicians, all of his wise men, all that, they can't figure out this dream. So the cupbearer goes, oh, I remember there was this guy in prison who was really good at this kind of thing. And so he gets them to bring Joseph up out of the prison. Joseph goes ahead and correctly predicts a dream again. What it meant was that there was going to be about 7 years of prosperity in Egypt, followed by a 7-year famine. And so he recommends to the Pharaoh that they need to gather up all of their, during the 7 years, a fifth of everything that's taken in needs to go to the government and be stored, so that when the famine comes, they have food and everything to give out. And because of his good idea, the Pharaoh puts him in charge of this whole thing. So he goes from prison to being in charge, back up on top there. So because of Joseph's wisdom, Egypt ends up, when the famine comes, Egypt's the only place that can really weather the storm. So what ends up happening is people from all over the region start coming in to Egypt to try and get some food and supplies and things like that to so that they can survive. A group of these people happen to be Joseph's brothers, who, again, have no idea what happened to Joseph. They figure they'll never see him again. But they show up, and they come face to face with Joseph. They don't recognize him, but so Joseph plays a few tricks on them, figure out what they're up to. But eventually, I'm skipping a lot of stuff here, but eventually he reveals himself to his brothers, and he accepts them, and he tells them, come back to Egypt, go back and get Jacob, come back to Egypt and live with me here, and you know, we'll reconcile, and that'll be great. So they do. They come back. So this is all of, and you got to realize that this family is basically the entire Hebrew people at this point. So it wasn't just his 11 brothers and their wives or whatever. This is, you know, probably hundreds of people. So they come back, and they live there, and Joseph eventually dies, and so that sort of sets up the story of the Exodus, which comes in the next book, which we're not going to get into tonight, but things don't stay so well for the Hebrews in Egypt. So anyway, there's a bunch of stuff there. I probably missed a few things, but I think that's the gist of it. If you didn't know the story, there's your crash course. If you didn't know the story, you can probably fill in the blanks. But anyway, the first kind of image I want to think about here in that story, which I think is really great, is this idea of the coat. There are a bunch of different interpretations of what this coat was, but most of the translations refer to it as many colors. So you can think it was like blended colors or stripes or whatever, but it was a bunch of different colors blended together to make sort of a mosaic. And I think it's important to understand that also that Joseph and his brothers, as I said, this is the Hebrew people at this time. The 12 brothers that make up, or that are Jacob's sons, are the 12 tribes of Israel. And Carolyn a few weeks ago talked about the history of Israel in a lot more detail than I'm going to go into. But essentially, this is where you get the different provinces and things like that going on. Hey, Mike. So anyway, the idea of Joseph being one of these brothers and being draped in this coat represents, I think, his role as a unifier of his brothers, of this people of Israel. He wasn't really great at this job when he was a kid, since most of the time, as I said, he was just telling his brothers about how they would bow to him. In the end, however, he was right. They did bow down to him, and he was able to fulfill his role as unifier for his family, and in turn, for the nation of Israel. So thinking about that idea of this image of this coat blending colors and everything, it's not a coincidence that this coat gets soaked in blood after Joseph's sold. I think it's very clear, like, this is an image of war. If the coat represents many cultures and nations and races of Israel at the time, but I think of the world, these separate parts of this coat represent what happens when you have multiple cultures and colors and people types and everything blending together. You get something that's much more beautiful than any of the separate parts. And I think that this is God's view of humanity. You know, he looks down and he sees everybody. And he sees this beautiful thing that happens when human cultures interact and different things like that. And I think that's the reason we're not all identical. You know, there isn't just one race. Our differences, as I said, create something more beautiful than any individual can, any family, any tribe, any province, or any nation on its own. And yet, despite these outside differences, what remains the same inside of each of us is our blood. There is no visual difference between, say, American blood, or Mexican blood, or Italian blood, or Indian blood, or Chinese blood. Blood is blood. And when we bleed, we're all equal. And so the beauty of these multiple colors of this coat become tarnished, and they can't, in a way that can't be erased just by washing it. This overpowering crimson of blood just gets into the coat, and its stains will linger forever. Just in the same way that, say, the specter of war continues to haunt every battlefield and every bloody limb and every broken relationship that it touches. The splendor of the coat is the ideal. Many different parts intertwine to make one beautiful image. The constructs of nations and borders is the perversion that humans have done to the beauty of that difference. So the provenance of Joseph's story reveals God's desire, I think, to connect the disparate factions of humanity, to unite the segregated people groups of the world. I think God wants humans to see beyond the rather arbitrary divisions that we put in place. Joseph and his brothers represent warring nations. They cannot live in peace or accept their differences as good, so they try to destroy the one that they don't like. Divisions such as clans, cities, countries, states, provinces, and continents, and races even, I think are all constructs. Are you familiar with this word, construct? It's something that we create that has no real connection to the natural world. So like a border, the border on the 49th parallel between Canada and the United States doesn't actually exist, except in our collective understanding of it. And of course, constructs can be very powerful. If you ever try and just breeze through it and say, this doesn't exist, you probably won't get very far. But in the natural order of the world, it doesn't exist. It's something that we've created. And humans create these divisions so that we can ensure unity within one group by excluding another group or a collection of groups. I'm going to do it with this water. One place you can see that right now, and I'm not, just going to put this out there as a disclaimer, I'm not dissing the Olympic Games. I know a lot of people are really into it. I'm not crazy about it, but other people are. But in the Olympics right now, you can see this sort of division and structure People, athletes from all over the world are gathering in London right now, and they're divided not based on age or weight or intelligence or eye color, but merely on which human-made borders they happen to be born within. So again, I'm not deriding the Olympics. After all, I think competing for athletic supremacy is much healthier than the last time everybody gathered in Europe to see who was best, which I think they called World War II. So, World War II is very complicated. I'm not minimalizing that either. The point I'm trying to make is that humanity does love to divide itself. Humans all over the world, for the next 2 weeks, will separately unite around the Olympic teams. And we're going to share in the accomplishments of our team and our country. And again, there's nothing wrong with being proud of accomplishments. Even the accomplishments of our fellow citizens. But what inevitably follows is a shift from national pride in accomplishments to national pride's sort of darker cousin, which is often referred to as patriotism, which is more of an irrational devotion to unnatural borders that we arbitrarily happen to be born within. And again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be proud of our home countries. There are many reasons to be proud to be Canadian. There are also many reasons to be ashamed to be Canadian. But what happens is, with patriotism, is that we begin to feel that our country and that we ourselves are inherently better than another country or another group of people based solely on where we were born. Patriotism is what causes us to demean other human beings. It's what causes us to forsake other human beings. And ultimately, it's what causes us to kill other human beings or millions of human beings in a war. It also allows us to justify it. And so what I believe that Joseph's story reveals to us is how this sort of division really does break God's heart. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have countries, because most governments can't handle their own country, let alone one government for the world would be a disaster. But I'm just saying we need to be open to each other a little bit more. And I think that that's what God wants. He doesn't want to see us kill each other over these divisions that we have created in spite of his hope for us. He created us to live in community, but like most things humans do, we perverted that idea. We want to live in community, but not with everybody. Just with those who are the most like us, or who think like us. And if you want, sort of, going back to this Olympic paradigm, for the next 2 weeks, we're all going to be very proud of Canada, and we're going to talk about our country as one. We're going to talk about the diversity of Quebec. We're going to talk about sort of the giant cities like Toronto or Vancouver. We're going to celebrate the beauty of the prairies and the grandeur of the mountains. But when we start to look within ourselves, we tend to start to segregate. We favor one part of the country over the other, usually our part over the others. BC tends to look down on Alberta. Manitobans like to poke fun at Saskatchewan. Ontario thinks it's better than everybody. most of the time, Quebec is a little embarrassed to be part of Canada, especially when France is hanging around. So this funny thing happens. And yeah, we're united around our athletes now, but wait until the Banjo Bowl in September and go to the stands and see how we react to Saskatchewan being in on our turf. And we continue to feel this way all the way down the line. Winnipeg versus Brandon, Transcona versus North Kildonan, downtown versus Osborne Village, my apartment versus your house. When I was a kid, my younger brothers and I used to even fight over whose room was better. This is what humans love to do. We love to divide ourselves in spite of God's better plan for us. And I think Joseph's story in this regard is important because it foreshadows Christ's story in the New Testament. Christ, too, was left for dead by his people. Joseph had sort of a figurative resurrection in his story, similar way to Christ's actual resurrection. The agony of the journey for both Joseph and Christ leads to a unification story. And so I believe that unity is at the heart of what God wants for us. It's at the heart of these two stories, and I think it's at the heart of everything. Even in the Old Testament, where it looks like God has chosen one people group as his own, he makes it clear that this choosing of them, this exceptionalism, is not for them alone, but so that they can be a blessing to the other people around them. Now, of course, this rarely worked in practice for the Israelites, but it rarely works in practice for Christians either, because that's kind of the human condition. Yet God keeps trying. He keeps finding ways for us to come together with each other and with him. Christ came and he abolished the old law, and he made it so that all nations and all people would have an equal opportunity to live in community with God, in relationship with God. It no longer matters in any way what nation we were born in, what gender we happen to be, what social standing we've landed in, what we look like, what language we speak, or who our ancestors are. We're all able to connect with God in the same way. And this is the beauty of God's love for his people. All people. There's no segregation, no borders, no others, no us versus them. There's just us. And I think it's a beautiful idea, this idea that God is constantly working to bring us together, to destroy the divisions that we've created between ourselves, which are, I think, meaningless to him. We can see this in the providence of Joseph's story and in the poetry of grace and of providence. And so, to kind of just make this point one more time, I'm going to share one more story. It's a little closer to home that I think makes this point. So the story begins in December of 1919. And then on December 9th, in the Bulacan province of the Philippines, there was a baby boy named Francisco Domingo. He was born in a small village. A few weeks later, on December 27th, in the Italian province of Abruzzo, in an equally small village, there was another baby born named Giuseppe Di Girolamo. Both of these men came of age in their respective countries during the battles of World War II, and although neither of them fought as soldiers, both were deeply affected by the battles that ravaged their homelands. In 1953, oh, we got slides. First one. Okay. This will get you. In 1953, Giuseppe married Felicia, and that same year they had their first daughter, Palma. Faced with little opportunities amid crippling economic conditions, post-war Italy, Giuseppe moved his young family to Canada in 1957. After moving around the country for a few years, the family finally settled down in Winnipeg, where Giuseppe's brothers had already set up homes. Francisco, over in the Philippines, married Angelina in 1946, and over the years they had 8 children. One of their daughters, Mercedes, took the bold step in the early 80s to seek better opportunities in Canada. So she left her entire family behind and went by herself to find work in the garment factories of Winnipeg. She established herself here and was eventually able to bring many of her brothers and sisters over. In 1959, Giuseppe and Felicia had another child, a boy named Romeo. You can go to the next one. Giuseppe and Felicia worked hard to make life for their small family in Winnipeg's North End. Giuseppe toiled pouring concrete in the summers and freezing through construction jobs in the winter. Felicia labored in various factories and garment shops for many years to make sure that their children were clothed, fed, and educated. In 1974, Paula met and married Cliff Penner, a non-Italian, very big deal. And over the years, they had 3 boys, David, Daniel, and Timothy. In 1982, after working a number of years, Mercedes married Ramon Cancino, who had immigrated to Winnipeg from another part of the Philippines a few years prior. The two also had 3 children, Jane, Janet, and Justin. Go to the next one. They moved into the Maples area of the northwest Winnipeg, and eventually both Francisco and Angelina left their homes in the Philippines for a life in Canada and moved in with Mercedes and Ramon. Giuseppe and Felicia bought a home in Garden City, also in the northwest part of Winnipeg in the early 80s, in order to accommodate their 3 restless grandsons who visited regularly. In 1997, Giuseppe died and was laid to rest in the country that had become his home. Eventually, Francisco and Angelina moved back to the Philippines, where he passed away in 2001. Angelina still, I'm still in a picture this summer. Sometime around 2001 or 2002, not really sure, Francisco's granddaughter Jane met Giuseppe's grandson Tim, and many years later, they got married, 2009. If you haven't guessed yet, Jane is Jane, and Tim is me. So anyway, so I've told this whole story. What is the point of the story? You may be wondering, probably. It's not an uncommon or remarkable story. Immigration happens all the time. People from different parts of the world share similar stories. Did you jump ahead? Go back and pretend like that didn't happen. Yeah. Okay. This is what I was going to say to lead up to that, and it was going to be great. I think what's really beautiful about this story is the way that separate factions of humanity are constantly being united by history and God-designed human longing for connection. It's remarkable to me because these two men, Francisco and Giuseppe, who were born within a few weeks of each other, on opposite sides of the world, who never met despite having lived less than 5-minute drive from each other, who sacrificed so much so that their children and grandchildren could live in a nation that not only respects but encourages cultural integration, will, in about 6 months or so, have a common descendant. Yay! They'll have a great-grandchild, not sure what kind yet, but it'll be a Filipino, Italian, German, Russian baby who will be born into a part of the world that neither of them had probably ever expected to be connected to. And this, to me, is the beauty of God's will, his never-ending desire to see us move beyond our self-constructed divisions, to abandon petty things like nationality and race, and to accept our place as a part of the human race. I don't know.